Good morning. It's time for us to begin this morning. I love a congregation that likes to talk to each other. That's a good sign. I want to start with Psalm 119 and verse 105. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. We started this quarter talking about marriage by saying this is going to be a Bible class. And the Bible is our standard, and nothing has changed. But I just want to reiterate that. I think it's good for this topic. We're talking about speaking this morning. Last week was listening. And we noticed in that first class that even well-meaning people, even experienced people who've been married a long time, can give you bad advice, terrible advice. And so the Bible's always our standard, as much as we appreciate advice from experienced folks. And we need to be aware of just how much we are affected by our upbringing and our culture and just the way things are around us. We may not realize that. Have you ever said something and thought, oh, that sounded just like my dad or my mom or whoever? I think we've probably all experienced that. And so maybe speaking is one of those areas there that especially we need the reminder we're trying to speak the way God wants us to. And we're really trying to look to the Bible as our guide here. Here's an example of that. We've studied Ephesians 5:33 in a previous class. The wife must see to it that she respects her husband. Here's another person's experience. She said, early on in their marriage, Jacqueline heard a woman tell her, never say a bad word about your husband. That was huge to me, Jacqueline says. Where I grew up, men were losers and women had to wear the pants. Every wife I knew talked badly about her husband. I'm so glad a woman told me that marriage didn't have to be like that, that we didn't have to talk about each other that way. That kind of negative talk would have been so hurtful to Donnie if I had decided to act like the wives I had seen while growing up. So that's an example of why we're emphasizing, look, this is a Bible class. We're looking to Ephesians 5:33, not the way Jacqueline grew up, as to how we're going to behave in speech and everything else. But maybe speech is especially a good time to remember that. James 3:2 said, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. It's just a really hard topic. It's just a really hard thing to do, to control our words the right way and to speak the way we ought to. So here's our topic so far. Let's talk about this first of all. Use a bunch of positive words. Look at the book of Job, please. Job chapter 13. Think about Job's friends and all the horrible advice Job's friends were giving him. Job chapter 13, here's Job's reaction. Job 13 in verse 4, but you smear with lies. You are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be completely silent and that it would become your wisdom. Look in chapter 19. This is Job just grieving over these terrible words that they're given to him. Job 19, verse 1. Then Job responded, how long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you have insulted me. You are not ashamed to wrong me. Okay, again. So part of Job's torture was sitting there and listening to these so-called friends saying bad things. And I think it's interesting that Satan killed all of Job's children but left these friends. Maybe as a calculated move, because he knew the friends would say stuff like that. And that was part of Job's torment. And he left his wife, too. His wife, who later said, curse God and die. So words can hurt. Look in the book of Proverbs, please, chapter 18. Proverbs 18. We just need to appreciate the power of words for either good or bad. Proverbs 18 and verse 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And those who love it will eat its fruit. Think about that. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. So words can do a lot of good or a lot of bad. A lot of power there. Think about all the verses we've read so far in this quarter. Look at this one again. Proverbs 21 and verse 19. It is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. What's it like to be with a contentious and vexing woman? Or as the CSB puts it, a nagging and hot-tempered wife. Well, that involves probably some actions too, but it certainly would include her words. Her words that are cutting and vicious and nagging, as the CSB puts it, powerful, powerful in the effect that they have. And the Bible's acknowledging that. It's better to live in a desert land than with somebody like that. How about Colossians chapter 3? Again, these are verses we've read previously. We're now just thinking about them in connection, especially to our words. Colossians 3 and verse 19. So kind of the same thing as what we just read, but on the husband side of it. Colossians 3:19, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Don't be embittered against them. What is a bitter husband like, or a harsh husband? Well, it would probably include a lot of things, but it's going to include his words, just like the woman in Proverbs 21. So our words are powerful. We need to be real careful with our words. Ephesians chapter 5, again, on the positive side, think about how husbands and wives fulfill these verses we've been studying so far this quarter. In Ephesians 5 and verse 28, so husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. Verse 33, nevertheless, each individual among you is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. How is that stuff going to be fulfilled? Well, actions, yes. But a lot of that's going to be through words. How does the wife respect her husband? How does the husband love and nourish and cherish his wife? Words going to be included in that. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, you husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. How do you do that? A lot of it's going to be words. Attitude, actions also, but words. And it also says, live with her in an understanding way as with someone weaker, since she's a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. How do you show her honor? Again, a lot of that's going to include words. So a lot of actions involved in these things, but a lot of words. So that's why we're starting this off with use a bunch of positive words. Think of it this way. It's your job more than it's anyone else's job on the planet to be your spouse's encourager, to be the one that admires them, encourages them, supports them, helps them. More than anyone else on the planet, it's your job. So, women, your husband may feel incompetent or stressed out or like he doesn't have qualities that other men seem to have. And guess whose job it is to be his biggest cheerleader? It's your job. And men, your wife may feel sad and critical of herself and like she's missing qualities that other women seem to have. Guess whose job it is to hold her hand and remind her of her good qualities? More than anyone else on the planet, it's your job. Use positive words. So all these verses we've been reading this quarter, we think about in regard to words, we recognize that's my obligation to do that. That's one of the ways that I fulfill these. That's one of the ways I nourish and cherish, love, respect, honor, understand, all of that stuff is coming through positive words. One wife gave her husband a journal she had worked on for an entire year. It listed everything she noticed about him throughout the year, mentioning specific things he had done on specific days that made her glad to be married to him. So here's some examples from her journal. Thank you for hanging the Christmas lights when it was freezing outside. You want our family to have joy. It was so cold, it must have been terrible. I wouldn't have wanted to do that, but you did. Thank you for traveling. I know it must be hard. I could see how tired you were when you walked out the door on February 6th. You do such a good job providing for our family. Thank you for coming home so tired from that trip in September, but still eager to spend time with the children. You're such a good father. When she gave him the journal, her husband immediately sat down in a chair and read the entire journal in one sitting. Later, when recounting this gift to a friend, he told him, reading that journal makes me aspire to be the man she thinks I am. And so she writes him a journal every year now. The power of positive words. You know, we say, sticks and stones may break my bones, words will never hurt me. And maybe that encourages us when we get insulted to try to let it go like water off a duck's back. But truth is, words are powerful. And the Bible acknowledges that. Go back to the book of Proverbs again, please. Proverbs chapter 12. Proverbs 12 and verse 25. Thinking about the positive power of words. Proverbs 12, 25. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs it down, but a good word makes it glad. Okay, so think of positive things you can say to your spouse. In the homework this week, I'm going to have some exercises for you to do, some compliments and some positive things to say to your spouse to try to prompt you to do some of these things. Hopefully you will have some fun with that. But, you know, we might think, well, my spouse already knows how I feel. I don't need to say it. And maybe they already do know how you feel. But almost everybody likes to hear it over and over again. I love you. Thank you. Whatever. You look nice today. All those kinds of things. Use those little words that means so much. Power of positive words. That's all throughout the Bible, the book of Proverbs, and all through the rest. It's a way to apply all the stuff we've been talking about. Okay, this is from the previous class. Remember that magic ratio of Dr. Gottman's in reviewing thousands of couples through the decades, and he's noticed, you know, as he predicts divorce, that you have this magic ratio of 5 to 1 in conflict discussions. In order to have a stable marriage that's going to last, the happy couples, the stable couples, had 5 times as many positive interactions as negative. And then that's in conflict. And then in everyday life, 20 to 1. So it's just far outshines the negative when we have the positive interactions with each other. Okay, let me pause there. Any comments, questions on the power of positive words? Anything you want to add so far? Jenny?
So back when I was in high school, I had went to drum major camp to learn how to be a better leader. And one of the things that they taught us was you don't want to do the 3 C's, which is criticize, criticize, criticize. When you're trying to correct something that you see wrong, you want to do PSP, which is praise, suggest, praise. So always start something with, hey, you're doing really good on this. Let's try this. But hey, keep doing this.
Okay.
And it's something that I have tried to do with, you know, child rearing and also, you know, being in everyday life, you know, like with working and everything. But it also does work with, you know, your spouse too.
Yeah, that's a good point. And last week we talked about the Corinthians, where Paul is able to find even some positive things to say about the Corinthians. As plain as he was about their sin, they were still positive there. John?
Favorite Proverbs covering language and how to address people is chapter 25, verse 11. When it talks about a word in the right circumstance, said the right way, it's like an apple of gold in settings of silver. What a beautiful picture of value you deliver to a person when you give words in the proper circumstance or context. One thing I would suggest, though, is we need to be aware of is don't sit there and praise somebody incessantly. Don't set up false hope. Don't make it something that is, that's all it ever is. If you notice, and I'm glad you put these ratios up here, there's still red in there. There are still things said that may not be negative, but that are in conflict. And that's okay. It's supposed to be there. And I would just leave everybody with this thought, too. I don't particularly care, I've learned over the years, how your spouse is behaving or speaking toward you. I care about how I am acting and behaving and speaking towards my wife.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you wait for them to do it to you, to be good to you, you have failed the mission of being the person who's what they should be, the husband or wife you ought to be. You can't wait on them to do it. You've got to be the person initiating. You've got to be the person doing it independent of everything else going on.
Okay, Matthew 7:12.
I think we brought up last week, you treat someone the way you want to be treated. Was that your hand, Keith?
I like the fact that you brought up Proverbs 12:25 about the anxiety in a man's heart weighs it down, but a good word makes it glad. It doesn't tell us here if it's someone giving you the good word or if you're giving someone the compliment, the good word.
Okay.
So it's an excellent thought to be able to, when I'm in this position where the anxiety, where life is being a whip, as I call it, that we start looking for the positive. Society wants me to believe that, hey, I grew up in this harsh environment. I don't have to. That's a lie.
Yeah.
That just encourages you to look for the good.
Yeah. Okay.
Here's something. Let me just throw this in. This is interesting. It's not on the spiritual side of things, but in one experiment, psychologist Kykel Glasser of Ohio State University had newlyweds fight, then took blood samples over the next several hours. She found that the more belligerent and contemptuous the partners were, the higher the level of stress hormones and the more depressed the immune system. The effects persisted for up to 24 hours. In an even more astounding study, Kykel Glasser used a vacuum pump to produce small blisters on the hands of women volunteers, then had them fight with their husbands. The nastier the fight, the longer it took for the women's skin to heal. That's interesting. First of all, how'd you get people to volunteer for this study? We're going to put blisters on your hand, and then you fight with your husband. But I guess they got a few, and they found out, hey, this seems to have an effect on the immune system. Marital distress raises the risk of depression tenfold. I mean, it's like the Creator knows all this, and he's given us these ancient instructions, like we talked about last week. Slow down. Quick to hear. Slow to speak. Avoid disputes before they break out. All these good bits of wisdom. Makes us, we think about that, it makes us reread Proverbs 18:21 with more depth, that life and death are in the power of the tongue. Interesting stuff there. All right, number two, plan your words carefully and soften your startup. Okay, so we've already been talking about this a little bit. Look in Proverbs 15, verses 1 and 2. Some of my most favoritest verses in the whole Bible right here. Most practical, helpful, if you believe in highlighting or underlining your Bible, this is a good couple of verses to do. Start with verse 1, Proverbs 15, 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Okay, if your spouse or anybody is rude with you, harsh with you, how do you immediately feel? Most of us feel defensive or offended or upset or something like that. You know, it just kind of puts us aback there. And there's a time and place for being plain spoken. Jesus was, his apostles were, the prophets were. We recognize that. But as a general rule, when we're just interacting in daily life, we ought to have a kindly disposition and be polite and gentle with folks until there's some urgent circumstance that requires otherwise. Verse 2, the tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable, but the mouth of fools spouts folly. Okay, let that one sink in. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable. Another way to translate that is the tongue of the wise commends knowledge, the ESV says, or makes knowledge attractive, the CSB, or makes knowledge look good, the Legacy Standard Bible says. So if I'm understanding that phrase, it's the idea that we're thinking of how to say something and maybe when to say something. So it's going to be the most effective. I make knowledge acceptable. Like Aquila and Priscilla taking Apollos aside and teaching him the way of God more accurately in Acts 18. That sort of thing. I'm trying to be wise in my tone, in my approach, in my wording, and all of that stuff so that I am the most effective. So if we apply that wisdom to marriage, we can do a lot of good. Maybe we need to bring up some problem. You know, there's something that needs to be resolved. Maybe I'm dissatisfied with the morning routine, the way our mornings have been going lately, or maybe one spouse is upset that the other one is spending so much money lately. Something like this. We need to talk about this. So Proverbs 15, 1 and 2 helps me to approach that in the best possible way. First of all, I'm going to start with a gentle approach, not a harsh word, but soft startup, positive approach. Use words that are accurate, not exaggerated. Sometimes we just blow the top off of this and exaggerate. Readily accept my part of what's going on. I know I'm doing part of this, and that's part of the problem. And so I'm accepting responsibility. Maybe I use a loving tone. I have a goal in mind. Here's the outcome we're trying to get to. I'm not just trying to be mad and cause a fight. You know, here's a goal I'm trying to reach. All that kind of stuff. Proverbs 15 is this ancient wisdom that's helping us do this right. Try to make knowledge acceptable, just like the proverb John read for us a minute ago. The research shows that if your discussion begins with a harsh startup, it will inevitably lead to end on a negative note, even if there are a lot of attempts to make nice in between. Statistics tell the story. 96% of the time, you can predict the outcome of a conversation based on the first 3 minutes of the 15-minute interaction. A harsh startup simply dooms you to failure. So if you begin a discussion that way, you might as well pull the plug, take a breather, start over. So this is Dr. Gottman, you know, with his Love Lab, where he's looking at thousands of couples and thousands of conversations, and this is what he's noticing. So I love it when, I mean, the ancient wisdom is here all this time, and then these guys come along and they notice the same thing we've been reading in the Bible the whole time. But he's noticing this same thing. Look, when you're harsh with each other, it stirs up anger. We read that in Proverbs 15:1, and here's a statistic. Go with it. He says, in his studies, 96% of the time, you might as well call it off, start over another time. Look at Ephesians chapter 4, please. These are some verses, not marriage verses per se. In fact, here it's talking about the gospel and sticking with the gospel, speaking the gospel in the correct way. But we're looking at a principle here that might help us as we communicate in marriage. Ephesians 4:15, but speaking the truth in love. We're to grow up in all aspects into him who's the head, even Christ. So again, the passage here in this context is about holding to the gospel truth, standing up for it, speaking the truth. But notice the way you do it. You do it in love. And that reminds us motive is important. Attitude is important. Speaking the truth in love. So last week we talked about listening. We got to listen with the right heart. And same thing this week. We got to speak with the right heart. Look at verse 29, Ephesians 4:29. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. Notice again, motive is being taught there. Speak with a positive goal in mind. Here he's talking about edification. You're trying to build somebody up. Okay, so for example, let's say the wife has filled her schedule with work, volunteering, hobbies, going out with friends, et cetera, et cetera. The husband wants to talk about that. Which is more likely to spark a productive conversation? He can say, look, you are such a pain. I'm here all the time alone. You're not doing any of this stuff around here anymore. I'm just by myself. You hate me. You don't care what's going on here. Or he might say something like this. Honey, I miss you. Can we spend some more time together? I love you. I feel like I'm alone a lot. What's going on lately? Which is more likely to have a productive outcome? I mean, Proverbs 15 is guiding us with God's ancient wisdom. That's what we're talking about here. Let's use God's wisdom to help us in our marriage. Proverbs again, please. Go back to Proverbs 12, 18. Actually, I think I've got it on the screen. There's one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Just another warning among many we have about speaking too quickly or too harshly. Okay, comments, questions on this one? Anything you want to add, confess to, anything like that? Wyatt?
Jenny mentioned the praise suggests praise over criticize, criticize, criticize. That's just like Proverbs 15:1 says. A soft answer, praise suggests praise, turns away wrath, but a harsh word, criticize, 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 stirs up anger.
Okay.
And just like the two options on you had on the previous slide,
yeah.
Each of those is one of the two.
Okay, good.
Donald?
A lot of people are heard. And if you don't give somebody the opportunity to be heard, they might tend to jump to those harsh words quicker. One of the hardest things for me to learn when I was starting out officiating was a coach just wants to yell and be heard. And if I give him that respect opportunity to say, 10 seconds, hey, coach, I hear you, and then move on. So he knows I've heard him, I've moved on, he comes back to the coach, we've moved on. If I don't give him the opportunity, he's going to keep escalating until he gets heard, right? In the workplace, same kind of thing. If you don't give your staff or your team members an opportunity to be heard with their concerns, questions, issues, it's going to become the fester, right? Take that to the relationship with your spouse. In that example you gave, you might start off with those kind words, the friendly words, right? Where, hey, I miss you, anything else. But if the husband says it to their wife, and the wife just blows them off, doesn't listen to them, or vice versa, it's easier for those harsh words to start creeping into your mind, because now you're like, well, they're not going to hear me. What do I have to do to be heard? And it causes the escalation. Now you start having friction between that relationship. So there's a lot of, we talked about listening a lot last week, but hearing somebody and processing that is critical in all of this. To keep peace,
yeah.
And understanding.
Yeah, this is powerful.
I mean, as God says, life and death are in the power of the tongue. Jim Daly said, when you're in an argument, imagine that Jesus is standing just over your wife's shoulder. Probably a good reminder. Okay, number three, let's talk about de-escalating. And when my spouse is trying to de-escalate, I respond to that in a positive way. Look in Ephesians chapter 4, please. Ephesians chapter 4. So if we do end up getting into an argument, we need to try to de-escalate and calm down. We read a lot of Proverbs last week about that. Remember, we just kind of went through the list. Slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. Just tons of that in Proverbs about being good listeners, and same thing would apply with being good speakers. James 1:19, quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. Here in Ephesians 4, notice verses 31 and 32, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you. This is one of those passages that talks about the old man, new man. You put off the old self, and now you become this new person. And as part of that, you're doing this. It has a lot to do with our speaking. So that's the way you used to be. Bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, slander. And now, kind, forgiving, tenderhearted, all that stuff. Look in Colossians chapter 3, same thing over here. This is another passage talking about old self, new self. And once again, Colossians 3, verses 8 and 9. But now you also put them all aside, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices. Verse 12, so as those who've been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as you, the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Again, same stuff. Look, I can't be that way anymore. That's the old self. And so if I'm slipping into that in a marital argument, for example, I need to recognize that and de-escalate. I can't continue to communicate in the same old ugly ways. That's the point. I'm a new person now. I'm in Christ. I'm growing and maturing in my attitudes and my words. And so can't be that way anymore. I just got to change. I got to repent. I got to change. Joanne was fed up. For months, she'd been asking Greg to not throw his dirty laundry in the bedroom floor. For months, he kept forgetting. He'd insist that the problem was that she was a terrible nag. Maybe if you'd leave me alone about it, I'd be more likely to do it, he'd tell her. One day, he arrived home to the sound of banging from the bedroom. He went in to find his wife still in her business suit, nailing his dirty boxer shorts to the oak floor. They'd been there for 3 days, she told him, so I figured you wanted to make them a permanent part of the decor. The next phrase is not surprising. Unfortunately, Joanne and Greg eventually divorced. This would be escalation. This is escalation instead of de-escalate. You see how dangerous and poisonous that is in a relationship where we're just going back and forth, and we're just up in the ante, and we're just so mad and uncontrolled. We just can't do it. We just can't do it. If we're trying to serve God and trying to have a healthy relationship, we just can't do it. Okay, let me show you some words. It doesn't matter the words we use. We're using Bible words because it's Bible class. So Ephesians 4, Colossians 3, those kind of passages. Gottman, this is one of the ones I keep quoting from. He calls these negative interactions in marriage the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because this is one of the ways he, if you have these in great prevalence in your marriage, it's one of the ways he predicts divorce in couples in his studies. So horseman number one is criticism, which is when a complaint turns into a global thing. So instead of saying, you're leaving your clothes on the floor, you're saying, you're such a slob. You're such, you know, you're attacking character, and it becomes a global thing. Contempt is what it sounds like. You're just contemptuous. You feel superior to the other, and it comes out. Jesus said, the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. So I have this bad attitude toward my spouse, and it's just going to come out in the words that I say to him. By the way, contemptuous couples have more colds and flus and viruses and stuff. Isn't that interesting? Another one of those physical effects. Defensiveness is just what it sounds like. We get defensive, and it's a way actually of escalating, because I say, well, it's not me, it's you. And so I escalate it back. And then stonewalling. This is the one I said last week. I was real bad about that early in our marriage. We were just talking about that yesterday. Nicole has a specific memory of, we were returning from a gospel meeting in Austin. We used to live in Austin. We were first married, and I clammed up. We don't even remember what the issue was. And I clammed up, wouldn't talk. And she remembers the road we were on in Austin. Driver said, how do you remember the road we were on? And she said, I think it was just the first time this happened to us. And I'm not bragging. I'm embarrassed of this. But maybe it'll help somebody. You know, this is one of the things I was bad at, stonewalling. And I would just not talk for like maybe a day or 2 days or something. And bad deal. I'm glad that I'm much better now than doing that. Sue Johnson's another one I keep quoting from. She calls them demon dialogues. Demon dialogue. These are negative patterns we get into. Find the bad guy. So Adam and Eve did that. Adam says, the woman you gave me. You know, you just blame, passing the blame. This is kind of a funny one. Protest polka. She describes it as the polka dance. So we're trying to connect with our spouse, and the other one is resisting or going away. So it's a protest polka. And then freeze and flee. She says that's when you just give up, basically. You're afraid of being hurt, so you don't talk anymore. You want to connect, but you're afraid of getting into an argument, and so you quit talking. So those are just bad patterns we get into. Whatever you call those things, it doesn't matter if you follow their wording. We're looking at Ephesians 4, Colossians 3, those kind of patterns. That anger, that clamor, that slander, that bitterness, all of those things. That's what we're trying to avoid and de-escalate when we see that stuff ramping up. By the way, isn't it interesting? We can control ourselves. If you're in the middle of an argument with your spouse and the phone rings and it's an important call, you stop yelling. Oh, hi, yeah. Oh, let me take care of it. and then you hang up, back to anger. You can't control yourself. Dr. Gottman noticed that in his studies. He said, let's try something. When we have some couples in our love lab that are arguing, let's interrupt them and tell them that the equipment stopped working and just to say nothing for a few minutes, and let's just see what happens. So he said, consider one experiment we conducted in the love lab. We had couples spend 15 minutes discussing a marital issue, and then we told them we needed to, quote, adjust the equipment. Over the next 30 minutes while we fixed the apparatus, we asked them to avoid the topic and just read magazines. When we restarted the experiment, their heart rates were significantly lower than beforehand and their interactions more productive. Remember last week we talked about that flooding, our heart rates go up, the adrenaline's pumping. And then here's this ancient wisdom, James 1:19, slow down. All those proverbs, slow down. Thousands of years later, a scientist is saying, yeah, you know what, that works. I love it. Also, they noticed that successful couples, happy, stable couples, would do that on their own without reading books and knowing to do that. They would just find a way to break the tension. So you're tense, you're emotional, and then they would make a goofy face or tell a self-deprecating joke or stick their tongue out in a silly way, not a mean way. And they would just, they would giggle, they would laugh, they would break the tension. And as silly as that sounds, they said that's a pattern you see in happy, stable couples. Isn't that something? Learn how to love and compromise with perpetual differences. Look in Acts chapter 3, please. Acts chapter 3. Some differences with your spouse will never have a resolution. Some types of issues are just not something where it's like you sit down and talk about it, come up with a plan, and the issue is gone forever. Now, let's make a distinction here. If we're talking about sin, it needs to change. No doubt about it. Acts 3:19, therefore repent and return so that your sins may be wiped away in order that times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord. So that's not what I'm talking about in this point. If we're talking about sin, that's got to be repented of. We got to get rid of that in our lives. So what we're talking about now are non-sinful things that are just differences between a husband and wife because you're two different people, two different upbringings, two different personalities, and you're just different. One of you is extroverted and wants to go to every potluck and get together and everything there is, and the other one is drained by that. One of you is a night owl, and one of you is a morning person. That kind of stuff. Not a sin, either way. It's just different. And if you talk to the same couple in 10 years, they're still going to be the same way. One of you loves coffee, and one of you knows it's bitter and disgusting. That kind of stuff. Just differences you're just going to have. It's just a perpetual difference. But those things can become, instead of just being like something we laugh about and, oh, why do you do that? It becomes this gridlock thing where bitterness develops. And there's no magic solution for that other than all the verses we've been reading all quarter from Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3, all that stuff, love, sacrifice, understanding, honor, respect. You just have to apply that. And stuff that's not sinful, you just kind of have to chill out about some stuff and just get along and recognize this is a different human being. You didn't marry a clone of you. And so there's just going to be differences that are perpetual. And you just kind of have to make peace with a bunch of those things and just live, you know, and realize this is kind of the spice of life. This is the difference is what makes things interesting. And just apply these verses. Just love each other. Just recognize. Now, you say, well, how is that? I thought the wife's got to be in subjection, you know. So, well, that's true, but what are we talking about with that? What does Ephesians 5 mean? The husband's the leader. The wife's in subjection to him. We recognize that, but that's not talking about micromanaging whether she likes watermelon or cantaloupe. You know, that's just a personal preference. Ephesians 5 is talking about being her spiritual leader to help her get to heaven and making sacrifices in that regard, not preferences of a non-sinful nature. So there's a lot of room in a marriage for mutual understanding, compromise, acceptance of your spouse, and their non-sinful differences. Okay, comments, questions on that? Anything to add there? Go ahead, JD.
Even when it comes to sin, that's not an excuse to just be a perpetual nag. Okay. And that's what Peter says in 1 Peter 3:1, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. So even when there's sin present, it's a problem that needs to be dealt with, but he shows us how to deal with it. And that is, everything else in your life doesn't get dragged down by that. You can still be kind, still be patient, you can still fulfill all of your duties towards them and show love and nourish and cherish, and all these things can still happen without condoning that sin, and is the best route to dealing with that sin.
Okay, that's a good point. It's not something you're content with, but you handle it the way 1 Peter 3 is talking about. Great point. 1 Corinthians 13, we've read a number of times, love is patient, love is kind, is not jealous, and so forth. Again, that's the sort of stuff we're applying here. Just be patient. Just be kind. In other words, just chill out on some of this stuff. If it's, especially these little preferences that don't matter, these different things, we just have to recognize we're married to a different human being. There was a show back in 2010 called The Marriage Ref. Jerry Seinfeld started this on NBC. And the idea was that three couples per episode would come on. They would describe some argument, ongoing argument that they had. And then a celebrity panel would weigh in. Martha Stewart was on there. Madonna was on there. Those kind of people. And then the ref, this guy, a comedian, would at the end announce the winner. Here's the winner of this marriage argument. And then at the end of the episode, the studio audience would vote of the three couples who was the rightest of the right. And so this person would be the rightest person. And they would get $25,000 and a billboard in their hometown announcing that they are right in this marital dispute. Well, the show was a flop. The producers, the goal according to the show's producers was to give couples something that they've always wanted but have never had, a clear winner. And so probably a lot of reasons that was a flop. But the point is, in marriage, we shouldn't think of it as there's winners and losers. We're two people, two different lives. We're living together in a way that glorifies God. That's the way we should think of it. I'm loving my spouse, not trying to be the winner in an argument. Okay, let me get this last point before we run out of time. Speak with clarity. Genesis 11 is the Tower of Babel. And, of course, God does not want that project to continue. It's a project of pride. They say, let us make a name for ourselves. And I like the way that God stops that project is to confuse their language, which is just a great illustration of how important communication is. You can't communicate. You can't stop. It just immediately puts an end to that project. So apply that to marriage. If a husband and wife cannot communicate clearly, how are you going to share your life together? What's going to happen next? You know, it's just not going to work. 1 Corinthians 14 is where Paul is talking about miraculous spiritual gifts, and he uses this same principle in the illustration here in verse 8. 1 Corinthians 14, 8, if the bugle produces an indistinct sound, who will prepare himself for battle? You're not going to, right? The communication is not clear. Verse 19, however, in the church I desire to speak five words with my mind, so that I may instruct others also rather than 10,000 words in a tongue. So he's talking about speaking different languages in an assembly there. That's the context. But the principle is, look, if people can't understand you, what's the point? Why are you even trying to communicate? And so again, we can apply that to marriage. I want to be as clear as I can in my communication and not send mixed signals or maybe the wrong signal, that sort of thing. I need to be clear and tell the truth. A lot of times we're just not, really we're not telling the truth. Are you okay? I'm fine. I'm not telling the truth. Maybe I'm embarrassed. Maybe I'm not ready to talk yet or something like that. But the more we can tell the truth, the better. How many times has a husband said, well, she never told me that? Now, maybe he wasn't a good listener, or maybe she wasn't a good speaker. Either one could happen, maybe both. Maybe she hinted, and it just whoosh, went over his head. He didn't get it. For whatever reason. We've talked in a previous class about the different ways men and women communicate, and that comes into play, and we just have to recognize that as part of our love for our particular spouse, recognizing how they communicate. Couples who've been married for at least 5 years were placed in separate rooms. Researchers asked the wives, during the last 6 months, have you and your spouse talked about who would be responsible for some of the household chores, such as taking out the garbage and other domestic responsibilities? 71% of the wives said, yeah, we've talked about that. 19% of the husbands said yes. There's some message being lost somewhere, right? Either they didn't talk about it, and she thought they did, or they did talk about it, and he missed it somehow. Here's another one. In the last 6 months, have you and your spouse discussed the possibility of increasing the size of your family? That's an important discussion. Are we going to have a baby? 91% of the wives said, we have talked about this. 15% of the husbands said, what is happening? The message is getting missed, right? It happens. And I think every marriage could probably say, yeah, that's the way it's been with us. We miss each other coming and going sometimes. So marriage places two people in connection who have come from different backgrounds and can communicate and think in different ways. We just have to recognize that. So you think about the verses we've been reading. Encourage the young women to love their husbands. Who are they loving? Their husbands. The particular human in the universe that they are married to. Same for the other way around. Husbands ought to love their own wives. So there's one person in the universe you're married to. You're trying to communicate in a way that's clear to that person. Maybe somebody else would have gotten the hint you floated, but not this guy. You need to be more clear with him. And vice versa. Maybe there's a different way you talk to your wife than you would to somebody at work, for example. That you can talk to them a certain way, but with your wife, there's a different tone. There's a different way. There's a different level of respect for your wife. This is the person you're communicating with. Be clear and honest and good. Okay, we've got a few minutes left for comments, questions. Earlene?
One on their own wife. How do you explain that to, is it the Mormons? It has two and three wives.
Okay, yeah, I think the official position on Mormonism is there's no more polygamy. I think in reality, I think it's been documented that that's been the case, at least in history. So I would say biblically that's wrong. You know, say biblically it's wrong. There were polygamous marriages in the Old Testament. I'm not sure that God ever approved of that. But when Jesus was talking about marriage in Matthew 19, he goes back to the beginning with just Adam and Eve. I think that informs our thinking. Yeah, old Solomon. Yeah, yeah. He was way off in left field. Yeah. Was it 300 or was it 700? 300 wives, 700 concubines. Okay. It's a lot of women. Yeah. All right. Sam?
All of this, it's really important to remember that this starts with you. I'm personally someone who my mind is going constantly, right? So it is really easy for me to get into rabbit holes of thinking about and obsessing about something that I'm upset about and thinking bad things about whatever that situation is, right? And so if you take a second to realize that pattern that you're in, it'll make it so much easier for you to have an effective conversation, because when you're in those patterns, you're in those rabbit holes of being contentious about whatever it is, those contentious words are going to come out.
Okay.
So this has been something that I've been actively working on lately because I still have this problem. And when I find myself in that pattern and in those rabbit holes, I found that taking a second and just saying a quick prayer helps to really like reset my mind into not being in those rabbit holes and thinking all those bad thoughts about things, be able to think more clearly. So that's a really good way to enter those conversations.
That's an excellent point. And that's a good example for the rest of us. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, Brent?
The stereotypical and to some extent true difference between men and women is that women, as a general rule, tend to focus on relationships and the home and nesting and building an area. And men are hunter-gatherers. I'm thinking of what I need to go out and get and go out and do and accomplish and all this stuff. And those are two completely different focuses. And when you put up that percentage of asking that question, you know, men, when some of those questions come up, okay, let me just answer this however I have to so I can go out and do this other thing, you know. But I guess the recognition of those differences is a big deal and for both parties.
Yeah, absolutely. I love those stats. I think, the gaps are so wide, it's almost hysterical. And it just shows us we're missing stuff. We need to be real careful, real clear. Okay, good. Anything else before we close? Teresa?
Is when your husband comes to you with something that he's disturbed about, repeat to him in the same words or different words, am I understanding that this is what you're saying?
Okay.
That slows everything down, gets your husband with ADD to focus on what where he really wants to go with this, and it helps you understand where he wants to go with this.
Sure, yeah, just making sure.
That's kind of like that speaker-listener technique we were talking about last week. That's good. So next week, Lord willing, we're going to talk about forgiveness for a couple of weeks. So we had 2 weeks on communication, and then it's probably appropriate next week, forgiveness. Okay, so we're going to work on that. Thank you for your attention this morning.